Coming to you live from day two of Sports Pro Live, it's the Sports Pro Podcast. Live. Hi everyone, welcome to the day two Sports Pro Live podcast. Wrapping up another excellent few hours of content here. We've had a whole load of things to talk about, a whole load of new themes to explore, some big names, some emerging names, some big ideas as well. Looking forward to going over them for the next half an hour or so, welcoming any questions that you might have from the floor if you are joining us live on the Swapcard platform. If you're joining us on the podcast, you might struggle, as discussed yesterday. But great to have you with us too. And I'm very happy to be joined to review all of this with Sports Pro Digital Editor Tom Bassam. Hi, Tom.
Hello, Owen.
And Ampere Analysis Consumer Research Lead Minhal Moda. Hi, Minhal.
Hi.
Guys, we have, I think media is probably going to be the principal theme. We've got some clips to dive into from Eurosport and DAZN coming up. First of all, Minhal, what have you been up to today? How was your session at Sports Pro Live?
Yeah, it was really good. So I was moderating a session on the importance of data when it comes to transforming business strategy. And I had EuroLeague, Volleyball World, WSC Sport and Cinemedia on. We learned about the importance of short form content when it comes to engaging younger viewers, and also still the importance of OTT and the data needed to be able to create those OTT services. So that is a theme which has been ongoing for the past few years, and it doesn't seem to be going away anytime soon. It was also really interesting to hear the rights holders talk about the importance of live and how we still have to sell an entire live match to audiences rather than maybe going down the US model of being able to clip up a quarter and selling that like the NBA has done. So yeah, it was a really, really interesting panel, and I urge everyone to go and watch it if they haven't done so already.
Yeah, absolutely. A reminder to everyone that if you do have a VIP pass for Sports Pro Live, you can enjoy all of these sessions again. There'll also be a lot of coverage to look out for, Tom, on sportspromedia.com, I have no doubt. Just on that point, Minhal, about the fourth quarter buy-in and the kind of in-game micropayments model. I mean, we're seeing Buzzer, who we've heard from, I think we're involved at Sports Pro OTT USA, for example, are expanding on that model with notifications and other ways of directing fans to live streams. What was the thinking about why these other sports might be a little bit further behind the curve on that?
So it wasn't necessarily that they're behind the curve. I think they were just slightly more hesitant about the business model because they still wanted to put an emphasis and get viewers to watch all of it and have a value across the entire match rather than offering people a segment of it and then maybe getting particularly younger viewers or new fans to that sport used to just being able to watch a quarter. It was mostly directed at EuroLeague just because there was such similarities between the two. But even Volleyball World agreed that for them, the priority is very much engaging fans to watch everything in the first instance and maybe innovating in terms of the way you experience the match live or innovating in different ways digitally, but not necessarily in potentially devaluing the value of the entire live match.
Yeah, different strategies for different rights holders and broadcasters. There's no one size fits all when it comes to digital media. Tom, you spent your day talking to the co-CEO of DAZN, James Rushton. We're about to hear a clip from him, but just what was the broad thrust of that conversation, first of all?
Yeah, I discussed this a little bit already on Twitter Spaces today with Sam Karp, and what I said then and what I'll repeat now, so apologies if you listen twice, is that it was a great session to start with. Like we kind of looked back at DAZN's last year and kind of looked at how that could be instructive for what's to come from them. So how they've kind of pivoted away from being almost a challenger media brand to really trying to consolidate in the markets that they've bedded down in, and also some of the sort of different ways that they're trying to approach their contracts, especially with their rights holder contracts, broadcast partnerships, however you want to call them, what they're doing differently in that sector. So that was the kind of broad thrust of it for me, and then there was obviously lots of other little bits and pieces that were there to pick out.
Okay, well, we've got a clip from James. What are we about to see here, Tom?
Yeah, so this is when I asked James about their new approach with the J League in Japan. I mean, this was a deal that was announced in summer last year. They basically agreed a kind of 2-year extension to their domestic broadcast partnership for the J League, but rather than go down the sort of traditional license model where you pay up front for the rights, they agreed a revenue share deal, which is a little bit different and something they were very keen to talk about at the time. They didn't think it was particularly prevalent in the industry, and still don't think it is really. So this is him explaining why they did that and what the kind of benefits are for them, really.
Okay, let's check in with James.
A risk and reward model whereby the sort of fees that we pay out to our rights holders grow in direct relation to the number of subscribers that we have based on the viewership that they generate. Clearly, from an economics point of view for us, is great because we have less risk at the start. Okay, we may pay out more in the outer years. The risk profile of that type of rights deal is clearly far more interesting to us than the classic license model whereby we have to pay upfront on day one and trust that we deliver the subscribers that we need to in order to cover those rights costs. I think in a more mature market, the reason why we like it, first of all, we think it's a fairer way of working with rights holders, and it's something that if you look at the music industry has been very successfully adopted by the streaming platforms of music. But what it also does is reward rights holders and properties that maybe drive viewership and therefore help us retain customers rather than necessarily rights and content that drives acquisition. And for us as a business, as we start to grow through this maturity curve, of course, acquiring new customers is important, but also as important is making sure we sort of continuously engage customers and manage our churn. And that's at the sort of what we call the rights holder part and the revenue share mechanic that's based on viewership, whereby a rights holder is rewarded for the amount of viewership they generate. We think actually is a more sort of democratic way of rewarding rights holders. And, we have, obviously, for confidential reasons, can't give you exact examples, but we have several rights holders that work with us in that way, whereby we're writing significantly bigger checks because of the day-to-day engagement that they generate or week-to-week engagement they generate. We're writing far bigger checks than we would have done if they were on a standard licensing deal. And that's fine by us because those rights holders deserve to be rewarded for the impact that they have on our business week in week and month on month.
You're listening to the Sports Pro podcast.
It's an intriguing model, Tom, and there's two things. DAZN have had an incredibly eventful year from a kind of leadership reshuffle to retrenchment and then advance again in the wake of the pandemic. But there's two things that they're doing that are particularly interesting right now. One is that kind of model, and I know it's not that extensive at the moment, but certainly something that makes sense for them over a longer period, or James certainly seems to think will make sense for them over a longer period. And the other is the rollout of the global service that they launched in December, where they have this low cost, mostly boxing led service in territories where they don't have, huge amounts of premium rights. What did you get from James about the kind of the strategy of DAZN at this point and how it's evolved from that? That very eye-catching run that they had in the first few years of operation, where they went around and they were buying up some some big deals.
Yeah, the global platform is particularly interesting. I think what it allows them to do, and it's allowed them to kind of pull back in certain markets in Brazil and the USA, but then it also means that they can be flexible. So, I mean, it's about sort of the Premier League rights very loosely, and it was talking about particularly bidding for them. But what he did say is that if there was the opportunity to do so, that having a global service means that they're set up that they can launch very quickly in any territory because they're already active. They've already got an active user base. They're already engaging customers around their other properties. So if there's an opportunity where they can go into a market, they're already set up to do so, and they just then need to scale. And so that was my big takeaway from the global platform side of it. And on the right side, it was really then just for me, it was about, it seems like they're going to be digging into those markets where they've already got a good market share and a good proposition already. So we're talking about Canada, Japan, Germany, Italy, and Spain. I mean, if you look at the kind of the deals that they've done there recently, they've acquired Bundesliga and Champions League in Germany. They've acquired the main broadcast package for Serie A in Italy. They've acquired MotoGP and Formula One in Spain, all very popular products in those markets. So what you're seeing is the zone becoming more mature, and also the fact that and also giving itself the flexibility to pivot. To me, it seems quite sensible. And I mean, I think for them, probably it was a little bit reactive given where they were around this time last year. They were struggling, you'd say probably to know exactly what to do next, because they were running a month-to-month subscription service for live sport, and there was no live sport. So in 12 months, I'd say it's been a pretty impressive rebound.
Mm. Minal, another thing they've done is diversified their output in key markets. They've looked to have access to linear platforms and to kind of traditional cable platforms and partnerships with carriers in those areas. They also have continued, as Tom said, to lay out a considerable amount of money on premium rights in the markets where they're established. What are the challenges for DAZN? What are the barriers to progress as you see them for a player like that, given how sports media is going to evolve over the next few years?
So I think one of the big challenges is obviously going to be the financial side of it, which it looks like they're trying to rectify with this new revenue share model. One thing I'd like to just quickly say on that is I actually think it's really innovative, just because it allows smaller players who maybe aren't as established to be able to enter a rights market and have a bit more of flexibility, I guess, to be able to bid for the rights, but not have to put out that money up front. Other challenges that they're going to face is if they can't get they've started looking into the linear channels and the carriage deals. I think that's going to be really crucial to their next stage of development. I used to work at 11 Sports, and some of our most successful markets, such as when I was there, we had Poland and Belgium. A lot of that hinged on the fact that you had carriage deals, just because although we talk about OTT, a lot of sports fans still traditionally like to watch on TV, and that's slightly reflective of the fact that they're a bit older. That's always how they've watched it. We might get to a stage over the next 5-10 years where new generations come in, and if there are apps available on smart TVs, people may start switching, and it might be okay to watch on a pure OTT platform. But right now, I really think having linear and OTT is going to be quite crucial for their success.
What do we think, guys, about other diversification opportunities they might have? I mean, you look at the two hires they've made in the last few months to join James in that leadership team. You have Shea Segev coming from the world of betting, from Entain, and a huge group there, which suggests maybe some kind of integration with sports books, maybe some kind of in-play offers there for bettors. And then you also have Kevin Meyer coming from Disney, where he was involved with the D2C operation. But, you know, that's an original content company. That's a storytelling company. And certainly it seemed like when he joined Access, that was a big part of his remit. Was that something you got into in much detail, Tom, those two hires?
The hires I asked him about, actually, and he said that it's like we shouldn't read too much into the backgrounds of the people being hired. But actually, I think that whilst he said that there will obviously be every media company at the moment, in, especially one in with a US operation, is trying to figure out how they can integrate betting into their offering. But I think the more interesting side of it probably is the original content side. That's something that when DAZN first kind of came to their attention, it wasn't really doing original content. I think I remember even SportsPro, we published a story saying where it was sort of hinted at that was something they were going to be moving into because it was something they hadn't done before. And now I feel like it's going to be a much bigger part of their offering, especially after the pandemic, where they were forced to kind of fall back on that in a lot of cases. So I don't know whether or not it's going to be Kevin Myers' influence, but I think that is something we are going to see more and more of from them, and they're going to be more of a content producing comes to just a live events service.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a bigger and bigger part of most sports broadcasters' remit in the years ahead, particularly as you know they look to fill out that bit of extra value on demand and drive audiences towards those live events as well. Speaking of which, another original storytelling company, what you might describe as a non-scripted, I think they describe themselves as a non-scripted entertainment company, Discovery. We had the Eurosport president, Andrew Georgiou, who heads up Discovery's sports output, talking to Nick Meacham at the top of the program today. Let's take a listen to what Andrew had to say.
For Discovery Plus, what I think it does is a number of different things. Firstly, you know, Discovery Plus and the Olympics, one of the challenges for Discovery Plus, candidly, is it's not synonymous with sport yet. You know, we've got to build, you know, Discovery Plus, and that brand has to become much more closely associated with not just the Discovery content, but also the sports content. And the Olympics, I think, will help move that brand positioning because it is such a large-scale event. I think will help us move that positioning of the Discovery Plus brand to a Discovery Plus brand that includes sport, which I think there is some work to be done. Eurosport, absolutely synonymous with sport, and I think that's really clear. But Discovery Plus, the feedback we've got from the market is, you know, oh, I didn't know there was sport going to be on Discovery Plus, and we haven't launched it, so why would people know? But I think the Olympics will do a really big and powerful job for really elevating the brand of Discovery Plus and really promoting sport as being a key ingredient of what Discovery Plus is. It will then also mean we're going to bring on a broader cohort of users. And what we saw in Pyeongchang was we got a really good uptake in subscriber numbers from Pyeongchang. And the Eurosport player was a really big beneficiary of that. But because the Olympic audience is so broad, we didn't have actually a broad enough audience to keep everyone on platform. You know, the people who were, let's say, more casual fans came on, enjoyed the Olympics on Eurosport player. But because there was no entertainment content on Eurosport player, the churn rate post-Olympics was higher than we'd want. The opportunity now with Discovery Plus is to bring a whole new cohort of users onto Discovery Plus using the breadth of the Olympic event to bring on those more casual fans. But now we've got this other great content that they can actually stay on and enjoy beyond the Olympics. So we're quite hopeful that whilst they'll come on for the Games, they'll stay with us for longer because actually now we've got more content, a broader offering to keep people on platform for longer.
This is the Sports Pro Podcast.
So I've done an absolutely horrible job of queuing up that clip because didn't really give very much context. Andrew there talking, of course, about Discovery Plus, which is Discovery's new OTT service launched in January. Multi-content strand offering, looking not just at Eurosport Player, which has been integrated into it, but at all the other programming that Discovery offers in lifestyle and history, documentary, that kind of thing. Now, Discovery seem to be doing two different things with the Discovery Plus platform and with sport more generally. One is kind of this vertical approach where you have things like Golf TV, the acquisition of GCN a couple of years ago, and what it already does in the Olympics through things like coverage of things like winter sports and serving specialist audiences across the continent. And then you have what Andrew's describing there, which is kind of bringing casual sports fans into the Discovery family through the Olympic partnership, which, you know, the biggest stage so far will be Tokyo 2020 later this year, and making sport a part of that kind of lifestyle programming brand. What's the opportunity for them there, do you think?
I think it's a pretty big one, actually. So I was looking at, we do regular consumer polling, and our latest wave was in Q1 2021. So prior to this, I had a quick look at our early adopters for Discovery Plus. And across Europe, what I found is that it skews very heavily that audience towards 18 to 34 year olds. So what the Olympics is going to be able to do is bring on potentially those slightly older consumers and older viewers. And then because they have all these other lifestyle brands and they have history shows, all these genres very much align with what these older demographics want to watch. So I actually think, you know, he spoke about Pyeongchang and how they had quite a lot of churn afterwards, mostly because they maybe didn't have some of this auxiliary content to bring to keep people. But I think this is such a huge opportunity for them, because once these potentially slightly older demographics come to their platforms, they probably stay because they enjoy everything else it will offer. So yeah, there's a really big opportunity for them this year.
And Tom, what we've seen from Discovery in its approach to Eurosport, I mean, they made a big splash early with that Olympic rights acquisition, and I don't know the extent to which that was reverse engineered into their strategy, or how many of these things have been reactive rather than a plan that was laid out ahead of time. But they do seem to have been able to find a lane that nobody else is quite set up to go down.
Yeah, isn't it? Like what he was talking about there with how they had viewers with Pyeongchang who then couldn't really find anything else on Eurosport that they wanted to watch because they were more casual viewers, and now they've got this this much broader platform which hopefully they can keep them in on. Personally, I don't know whether or not, like, yeah, it doesn't strike me as being particularly strategic. It seems a little bit more like, let's get some really cool stuff and then we'll see what we can fit around it. I don't know. It doesn't seem as natural for me as you've seen with other platforms. I think they've done more interesting stuff away from, like, in the sports side anyway, away from the Olympics. So with their dedicated cycling stuff, with like you said, with Golf TV. Like, for me, those are kind of those are more interesting. This is just like, this is going to be a home for everything. And if it's got sports on it too, that's great. But I don't think that I feel like it's kind of reverse engineered, as you said, for the Olympics to squeeze this onto Discovery Plus. But that's just my take, and it's based on zero analysis. I'm just a consumer at this point.
Zero analysis is very much on brand for the Sports Pro podcast. The other point that Andrew made was about the breadth of Discovery's access to the audience more widely, and that, you know, Eurosport is where people perceive it as having sports output, but obviously from market to market, that's variable. There are some places where they have premium rights on free-to-air, and there are some places where they have specialist rights behind the paywall. And I think we will continue to see a bit of an evolution of Discovery as a sports brand. It will be fascinating to see what opportunities they pursue over the next few years. We are still open for questions and comments from the audience for the next few minutes. But before we just leave this broadcast portion of the conversation behind, Minal, I wanted to get your take on the news that came out of the Financial Times overnight that BT was looking at selling a portion or perhaps more of its sport business, its sports broadcasting business here in the UK. What was your reaction to that?
Honestly, not very surprised. I feel like there have been murmurings about BT potentially pulling out of sport for the last couple of years. Initially, I didn't think it would be them selling the arm. I thought it would just be a case of maybe gradually pulling out of some of the major rights that they have. But what we've seen in the past is a lot of telco-led services don't necessarily survive in that content space because their strategy is still very much linked to selling broadband, selling telephony, rather than going full hog in and being a pure content player. If you think of Sky's strategy, you know, they have diversified massively. They have a lot of Sky Originals in terms of TV shows, in terms of movies, etc. Whereas BT's core offering has kind of been built on their broadband, having carriage deals, but then also their premium sports rights. So it might now not be making a lot of financial sense. It will be interesting to see if they do go down this route, who comes in to buy that? Just in terms of financials, you know, you can imagine the likes of Amazon coming in, but would DAZN potentially see this as an opportunity? You know, they were beamed in the papers and stuff today. It might be potentially slightly too much of a financial risk for them. But, you know, like Tom was saying earlier, their whole play is because they've gone global, they now have the infrastructure to be able to do this. So it would be very, very interesting to see who the players are who would maybe come in for this.
Yeah, I mean, the legacy of that position in the UK sports market is interesting. It was Satanta, then it was ESPN, which is now owned by Disney. Could it be a way back into the UK market for Disney?
Potentially. I was actually talking to somebody about this last week, and I think it's that little bit too soon for Disney at the moment. You know, when you look at their commissioning strategy, they have announced an entire slate of new TV shows and films, and they're spending so much money globally to acquire new customers. And, you know, it's working really well for them. I can't see them at this point in time going gung-ho for a local play in the UK for the Premier League. Maybe in the next cycle, in 3 years' time, it might be something they will look at. But my hunch is they will still focus on their TV and movie originals for now and build up that global subscriber base before turning their focus to maybe localized sports rights.
Okay. One to watch. Tom, I understand you've got to take off any minute now. But do you have a bit of time to tell us about other things you've caught today and in particular about Whoop?
I thought this is a fascinating session, actually, hosted by Ed, one of our staff writers. And he's Will Ahmed's one he's spoken to before, and you can kind of tell from the fact that they just kind of understood where the conversation was going, what it was about. But there was a kind of, we're working towards one clip in particular, but the story of Whoop is almost the story of the pandemic, because what they've done in the last year is change from being a kind of, okay, we're a cool tech company who do nice wearables, into being something that's like now almost, it could be essential for some sports rights holders. It allows them to track certain measurables, which are indicators of whether or not someone has COVID, which in a world where you probably need to know that information is quite important. But what I took away from it was less about, okay, how can I adapt my business to be something that provides a solution for the current pandemic, and more about thinking laterally and being a business that's able to like see an opportunity and work out how they can do that within their current business structure or within the platform that they offer.
Okay, let's see what Will has to say.
In March of 2020, we had over 2,000 people report having tested positive for COVID-19. So we rapidly had one of the largest data sets on what does your physiology look like before, during, and after COVID-19. We then partnered with leading research institutions, and by the summer had published research showing how an elevated respiratory rate could be a predictor of COVID-19. And now today we've had tens of thousands of Whoop members use an elevated respiratory rate as an early indicator for COVID-19. So that's one example of how you as a business react to the environment and create value for your members, you know, because you've created that relationship, because it's a subscription, and because your responsibility is to continue innovating and continue releasing features quickly.
Print, digital, events, podcasts, Sports Pro.
Interesting stuff. And I suppose the broader theme, Tom, is that, you know, we've spent the bulk of this podcast talking about the movements at the very, very top end of the sports media market, where the cost of entry is incredibly high, where even though we're seeing pretty substantial transitions from one model to another, it's going to take time and it's going to take investment and it's going to take a degree of patience and risk. But at the other end of the market, where you're seeing athletes investing, where you're seeing startups emerging, there's the potential for things to happen very, very quickly.
Yeah, and Whoop is one example of that. I think Hyperice and Therabody and other examples of that, where these are the kind of new entrants and they're able to prove that they're worth something to the people that use the products. So in the case of Whoop, that's measurables. In the case of Therabody, that's like recovery. But they're all kind of roughly in that same kind of field of performance. And they can see, like, if you're able to prove that your product's worth it, you can quite climb and become something that's relatively significant if you're smart about it. And like you see, I think you're seeing more and more of that with tech companies, especially those entering sport. It's probably why we launched Ideas to Invest In Now a couple of years ago.
Seamlessly done. looks like we've got quite a shy audience, so I don't know that we're going to be taking any questions from the floor before we wrap up. So, Minal, I'll go back to you and just ask if there were any other bits and pieces that you picked up over the course of day two here.
So just going back actually to my own panel, I found it really, really interesting when they were talking about, we actually had a question come in about for businesses who are maybe not digitized enough, how do you get them to pivot towards data and AI? And nearly everybody talked about how you need to build really small to begin with. You know, we work in an industry where big data is hailed as everything, and you know, people talk about data all the time. But actually, even if you have a little bit on your consumers or on your clients or whatever your product is, you can actually have a really big impact on your future business strategy. So I thought that was quite interesting, because when I think of data, I do tend to think of like having quite a lot of it in order to back up all your strategy. So that whole idea of, you know, building those foundations to start really small and then working your way up from there once you've convinced people that things are working because you've pivoted towards data. So I thought that was quite good.
Yeah. And I think a basis to build from is, you know, something valuable for anyone to take away from an event like this. While we're on the subject of actionable insights, tomorrow, if you're joining us for Sports Pro Live, you will be able to catch a series of masterclasses from experienced industry professionals who will be taking you through everything from building out sponsorship plans to rebuilding football clubs to establishing a presence on TikTok. Should be informative, should be enjoyable, should be extremely valuable, I'm sure, or a lot of those of you watching. But that is it for the main content, or the content on the main stages here at Sports Pro Live. It's also it for the Sports Pro Live podcast. Thanks very much for joining us over the last couple of days. Thanks to those of you who have submitted questions. Thanks to everyone for listening at home, as always. And thank you to Tom Bassam.
Thanks, Owen. Thanks, Minal.
Yeah, and thanks to Minal Moda.
Thanks, Owen. Thanks, Tom.
Enjoy day three if you're going to be watching. And to everybody else, I'll be speaking to you again very soon. Bye-bye.
The Sports Pro podcast is published by Sports Pro Media. The producer is Ed Dixon.